This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you so much, John, for inviting me. How you doing? Oh, come on. I'm supposed to put you to sleep. You can't start out asleep. Come on. How you doing? Much better. I know that officially at UCSB, officially it's the weekend. Is that right? After 5 o'clock on Thursday starts the weekend? Okay, I'm sorry. I'm cutting into everybody's happy hour time. I'm very sorry, but thank you very much for being here. I almost did not recognize myself from that introduction. I was sitting back there going, wow, this guy is good. Wow. I hope he's something that's relevant to me. But I've already had, I think, the quintessential UCSB student experience. I've only been on campus for an hour, and I've had a slice of pizza at Woodstock's, and I've been run over by a bike. So that's pretty much what you need to for orientation. And by the way, watch out for the bikes, but it speaks well of the student body, because this is the kind of ruthlessness that when you get out in the world, this will serve you in very, very good stead. Just out of curiosity, before I tell you anything about my background, in addition to what John has said, and frankly, I'm delighted to be here because even though it's a distinguished speaker series, I'm pretty sure I can handle the speaker's part. The distinguished, I'll leave it up to you. But I'm married, I have two kids, so I really don't get to talk that much at home. So anytime somebody says, would you like to come out and talk to the... Yes, the answer is absolutely yes. So before I tell you a little something about my background, and maybe there are some war stories, some successes, some failures, some more failures, a little more failure, and then another success, let me just get an idea of who's here. Because first of all, you've shown amazing insight into picking an engineering course that actually involves no engineering. It's fantastic. It's the kind of engineering course that I would take. There's an engineering course that doesn't involve any engineering. No, I'm good. Sign me up. I'm going to be there. How many people here are juniors or seniors, undergraduates? Oh, fantastic. And just by applause, how many people have a pretty good idea what they're going to do when they graduate? Okay, all right. John just got a little afraid. How many people very proudly have absolutely no idea what they're going to do when they get out? Hey. Okay, I think I've shown up just in time. The thing about the distinguished speakers aspect of this is that I come from the comedy business, and there is almost nothing distinguished about comedy, and nothing distinguished about the comedy business. It is a far messier, less fair, ickier business than anything I think anyone in this room will find themselves doing. You have to make decisions on incredibly incomplete information. The customer feedback that you get is immediate, it's personal, it's public, it's often humiliating, it's brutal. Sounds like fun, doesn't it? But I started out, as most of you did, as a child. But what... it's this kind of insight that John noticed in order to bring me to his finely curated speaker series. But when I was a kid... and he still lives inside of me. But when I was a kid, I was all about comedy. This disappointed my immigrant family, who wanted a doctor or a lawyer, and they just didn't understand. They barely spoke English. But the reason I'm putting this up on the board is because it represents a... Anybody remember Venn diagrams? Hello? Okay. Let this set be all the stuff you love to do. whether you think it's marketable or not marketable, whether you think it's legal or not legal or whatever it is, let this be all the stuff you love to do. And let this set be all the stuff that's monetizable in the world. Okay? Now, to be in this set and to make the very common mistake of, well, I love doing fill-in-the-blank comedy, let's say. Stamp collecting, horseback riding, art, surfing, drinking, whatever it is. That's what I love to do, and I'm going to make a living doing that. Well, this is where starving artists come from. If you live over here in this set of everything that's monetizable, and you don't care at all about this, that's where a lot of failures come from, and a lot of unhappy people come from here, if that's all you're focused on. What's really interesting, and you'll notice it's a very small subset in the intersection of these two sets, and that's this. You're looking to hit a pretty small target, and that's the intersection of the two sets, the stuff you love to do and the stuff that's monetizable, and how can you make one into the other? And that's the story of the Comedy Cellar. When I was a kid, I was one of those kids that in camp would help write all the shows and direct all the shows. I was that guy. One step above the AV group, sorry crew, with the plastic pocket protectors. Just one step above that and the movie projector guys. And when I got into college, it started coming out like the toothpaste in a tube. It started coming out, and I started doing shows around campus. And this was way before there was any such thing as comedy clubs. This is when people going, you're going to do what? You're going to stand up and talk? And what? Why? And so the first order of business was to create a place in which to do it. And that grew from the campus to the Philadelphia environs. I went to Penn, so West Philly and downtown, and we would have to talk people into letting us work for free, which is an odd thing to do. But what we were learning was much more valuable than money would have represented at that time. Then, when I got out of college, when I was 22, I started my first comedy club in Boston. I was living in Boston at the time. And I started my first comedy club, and it failed. Then, at 24, I had moved down to New York City, and I opened my first comedy club in New York City, and it failed. And then, when I was 25, I opened the Comedy Cellar, and it's been open for 31 years. The object lesson that we can all take from this, first of all, I hope, is failing is okay. Especially at your age. It's one of your superpowers right now. Failing at my age is kind of pathetic. But failing at your age is fantastic. And in fact, we could probably just, let's call my little section of the speaker series, How Not to Live with Your Parents and Have an Unpaid Internship for the Rest of Your Life. Okay, that's what we're going to try to avoid. Because you guys have been sold a certain set of ideas. You may be hearing now that you might be the first generation that's going to do less well than the previous generation. And now on top of that, to add insult to injury, the previous generation that screwed it up for you is trying to get you to accept this new normal thing of decreasing your horizons. Yeah, that was good. Yeah, all of that stuff. Yeah, fine. Doing the thing you love to do and monitor. That was good back in the old days in 2006. But hey, buddy, we got bills to pay. And one of the things I would like to implore you to do is to reject this whole idea of the new normal. Let somebody else be a victim of this new normal thing. Don't allow yourself to be a victim of this new normal. So, how and why did I start the Comedy Cellar? And by the way, if you have any questions, just raise your hand or yell them out or toss them up here, because I'd love for this to be as much of a conversation as possible so that we know that this is relevant to each of your experiences. I mean, I've had a lovely drive. Santa Barbara is beautiful, but I really want you guys to get as much of my being here as is humanly possible, okay? So I started the Comedy Cellar. The business model of the Comedy Cellar, and I'm always going to be going back to this. The business model of the Comedy Cellar was not, hey, I'm a comedian. I'm going to open a comedy club so that I have a place to perform. That business model would have lasted about 2 weeks because, first of all, I was not that good. And I kind of knew it. But I was good enough that I could tell who else was good. I could curate. That is really the operative word here. Curate. In showbiz, they use words like producing or being an impresario, depending on how fancy you want to sound. But because I was a player, I understood, and maybe it's one of the odd skill sets that I have, I understood how to tell who was great and who was almost great and who was very good and who was pretty good, who was almost pretty good, and who was really stunk. And who was on brand and who was off brand? Because there were people back in those days who could kill, who could stomp on her, who could crush it. And I wouldn't book them because they were off brand. And I knew that they would kill that night and the wrong people would come back. The wrong people in the audience would come back. Not to sound too elitist, but there's a group of people in the tri-state area. We used to call them the Bridge and Tunnel crowd. The Bridge and Tunnel crowd now is much wealthier than it used to be and much better educated. But you could have built a comedy club that could have lasted for 3 or 4 years on the Bridge and Tunnel crowd. But I had my eye set on something larger. I didn't expect it to be 31 years, to tell you the truth. I just wanted to survive. The incumbent clubs, Catch a Rising Star, The Improvisation, The Comic Strip, they should have crushed me. But they didn't. So the question that you can ask in a little while, somebody please remember to ask it, is why? But when I started the Comedy Cellar, it was coming off of a failure. I had started a place on the Upper West Side in the back room of the Swiss Chalet Barbecue. And this speaks to the fact that if you want to really be a success, you have to be willing to do anything, even if it means starting a comedy club in the back of a barbecue joint. And there's nothing distinguished about that. But it didn't work for a number of reasons. And so I left. And I said, well, what am I going to do? Because I still need to start a club. I saw that that's what I needed to do next. And the seeing is kind of important because there are three basic principles. They just don't make chalk the way they used to. There are three basic principles, three axioms that whenever I have succeeded at something, it's because I've adhered to these three axioms. And whenever I have failed, when I look at it, I realize I did not adhere to these axioms. And the first axiom is no. If you're going to get what you want, if you want to get what you want, you have to know what you want. Now, our opening question of, you know, who knows what they're going to do when they get out, this is sort of a dicey area. You might want to look at it. And I think that the reason that a lot of people, look, it's completely natural, normal, healthy for somebody who's in college not to know exactly what it is they want to do. But by the time you get into your junior and senior year, you've had so many messages coming at you about what is allowable, what is appropriate, what is realistic, what is, and all that stuff. Very few, very little of the messaging is, what do you love to do? Start there. So knowing what you want, even if you never get it, we can talk about how do you get it and the odds of getting and all that stuff. But first, you got to be on. You got to know. The second is you got to see. You have to, and this sounds pretty Tony Robbins, but honest to God, you've got to envision yourself having it. Envision yourself with the thing you want. See it. Feel it. See all the details. Where are you geographically? What room are you in? What are you wearing? Who are you talking to? What are you doing? See it, feel it, be it, own it. And then do. What are you going to do? What's the action plan to doing it, to getting it done? So I knew what I wanted. I wanted to start my own comedy club. I had had my Boston mistake. I had actually discovered Stephen Wright in Boston. And he is exactly as he appears to be, by the way. Brilliant, and he does smile more offstage. He does smile more, and he does laugh more. He doesn't like people to know that. So I did something positive and good for comedy while I was up there, and I did something else positive in a very negative kind of way and turned somebody into an extremely rich guy. His name was Mitch Kapor, and he developed Lotus 1-2-3. I don't know if you remember. Does anybody remember Lotus 1-2-3? Okay. It was back in the day when they had computers made out of wood. It was a very, very big thing, huge, one of the first, and he made a gazillion dollars. And I take credit for Lotus 1-2-3 because Mitch Kapor came to my club and went on stage because he wanted to be a comedian. And I said after he got off, Mitch, you stink. I'm telling you, out of love, you stink. Forget about this. Why in the world would somebody with your brain and your ability, why would you want to waste it on a comedy club stage, especially when you stink? He was a little upset. But then turned his back to comedy and went off and developed Lotus 1-2-3, making a gazillion dollars. And so I, in a very odd way, am responsible for the advancement of technology in America. So learning those lessons, and by the way, if you think doing it in the back of having a comedy club, in the back of, if you could run around so it sounds like everybody's laughing, I'd appreciate it. Back of a barbecue restaurant is not that distinguished. In Boston, it was in the back of a place called the Springfield Street Saloon, which was a chuck wagon-themed restaurant, with beans and hot dogs and, you know, and then later became the Ding Ho, exactly as the name would imply. So if you're willing to work in these places after you've gone to the University of Pennsylvania and done what your parents view is thrown out all this tuition money, in order to get an unmarketable degree in psychology and then turn your back on the family so that you could entertain a career in comedy. And I'm just guessing that this is how they felt. There's no way for me to be sure other than the constant reminders on a daily basis. But, you know, you can't take them seriously. So based on those two failures, the Comedy Cellar in New York, I knew the Upper West Side wasn't going to work. I called some people. There was a comedian, Dom Irera. I haven't said that name in years. And Dom said to me, Bill, go to the Village. Just check out what's going on there. I went down to Greenwich Village, and I saw this sea of people, and they all had a problem. The problem was they were going down to Greenwich Village, they had cash money in their pocket, and they didn't really have a lot to spend it on. And I felt that just as a humanitarian, it was really incumbent upon me to provide them with a place where they could spend this money that they had. There were jazz clubs, there were folk music clubs, there were coffee houses, there were restaurants. There was no comedy club. I said, well, gee, I would really have to stink in order to fail here. And I watched as the people would wend their way through the village, and there seemed to be like a track. It was like ants. You ever watch ants? They follow each other. For some reason, it was from 6th Avenue down West 3rd Street, and you turn on McDougal Street, and then you make a left on Bleecker. And that was it. And if you were on the wrong corner, had I opened the Comedy Cellar in a slightly different location, I would not be here today. The location, just as traffic online, if you've got a massive amount of traffic, you can cover a lot of your mistakes until you figure out what you really ought to be doing, until you perfect it, until you are as good as you claim to be. And I went to the guy who owned the building. He owned the building. He owned the restaurant, which is called the Olive Tree Cafe. It's still there if you're ever in the village. It's a wonderful place, and I still have a terrific relationship with them. It's like going home every time I go back there. It's a quintessential Greenwich Village nightclub and restaurant. But as I was walking, just wearing out pairs of shoes, and just I would always use the same thing. Listen, I have to go to the bathroom. Where is it? Because it's always in the back, downstairs, upstairs, whatever. And I saw every upstairs, back room, downstairs in the village. And I saw this little staircase, and it had chains, and it had homeless people using it to relieve themselves. Again, not very distinguished. But as we've learned from Ding Ho and, you know, the barbecue restaurant, is homeless people relieving themselves in front of the potential place? Is that going to stop me from inquiring about it? Is it?
No,
it's not. But it stops most people. Most people see something icky, see some kind of resistance, and they go, no. And that's one of the object lessons. The world is not a dangerous place. The world is not waiting out there to beat you. The world is not going to beat you. You will beat you. It's always an inside job. It's always you stopping you. The world isn't thinking about you at all. It's not thinking about you to the good. It's not thinking about you to the ill. The world could care less. The world is like the guys riding the bicycles out here. The world is ruthless. And if you take that kind of bike ruthlessness into the, you're going to be fine. So I saw that and I said, well, I don't know what it is, but let me go down there. Let me brave the homeless people relieving themselves and see what in the world is going on down there, because this is a dandy location, and if there was a comedy club right down those stairs, I think it would be great. So I lied, went into the and found, yes, you the bathroom's downstairs, and I went around and I stood in the middle of this place, and it had a piano and had low ceilings and brick walls, and I said, this is it. I need to do whatever it takes to make this mine. I had no money. People were telling me, Bill, how are you going to start a comedy club in Manhattan? You don't have any money. What about, what are you going to do about rent? What are you going to do about food? What are you going to do about insurance? What are you going to do when the mob guys, because they were just down on the other side of Houston Street, not even on the other side of Houston Street, what if they come by and they want a piece? What if they want to put a cigarette machine? What if? Plus, the great one, I always love this one. If starting a comedy club in Greenwich Village was such a good idea, wouldn't somebody else have already done it? When you come up with your idea, I promise you, the last line of defense is going to be somebody saying that to you. This is what I call the caveman objection. Because when Og discovered fire, you know his wife said, Og, if fire was such a good idea, Don't you think somebody in Cave 76 would have come up with it already? No, you're the smart one. You're smarter than everybody in Cave 76. Fine. Okay, fire. Good idea. Oh, the wheel. Aye, again, this guy. If the wheel was such a good idea, don't you think somebody else would have come up with it? The answer is no. No, I don't think somebody else would have come up with it. Somebody had to see the thing first. Somebody has to see the opportunity first, and it's me. And let it be each one of you. Because no matter what you do, whether you're an entrepreneur, whether you're an employee, you're going to have to take some kind of proactive action where you're the one that sees the opportunity before somebody else. And sadly, I know we all grew up in this kind of kumbaya world, but sadly, you have to believe that success, being greater than others in comparison to others, that success is something you deserve. And that's a mindset that's kind of tricky to get into. So I started the Comedy Cellar by finding this place. I went to the owner of the building. He was an Israeli guy who was also an oud player. I don't know if you know anything about Middle Eastern restaurants. And he had a band, a Middle Eastern band, and he owned this building. And I said, here's what I want to do. What are you doing downstairs with the basement? He said, well, we do a Brazilian piano bar. Okay. When does it get busy? 10 o'clock. Okay. Here's what we're going to do. I'm going to start a comedy club in the Brazilian piano bar at 8 o'clock, from 8 to 10. We'll be out of here by 10 o'clock. We'll charge a cover charge. We'll charge a minimum. I'll keep the cover charge, and I'll pay the comics, and I'll pay for the advertising and the marketing, and I'll make sure that there are people here. And you sell them food and beverage. There's no way for you to lose. So I presented him with a win-win situation. Usually, if you put yourself in the other person's shoes, and if you understand where they're coming from, try to understand where they're coming from. If you don't understand where they're coming from, just ask and actively listen to what they say. They will usually tell you. They will tell you what you can say to them that will cause them to say yes to whatever it is. And that starts with listening, not with talking, even though I have been doing a lot of talking. But I'm looking forward to also listening. So if you can create a win-win situation for somebody, you're going to get a lot more yeses than you would otherwise. And the first night we opened with Thursday, Friday, Saturday. We're going to do shows Thursday, Friday, Saturday from 8 to 10. And I said, and if any of our people want to stay for the piano bar, they stay for the piano bar. If your people come early, they don't have to pay a cover charge to me or anything. It was all very open like that. By Saturday, the third day of our opening, we already had repeat customers from Thursday. And Manny, who has left us a few years ago, sad to see him go. He was a great guy. Manny and I looked at each other and said, you know something? We may have something here. Just off of a couple of repeat customers, because he understood, especially in New York, what a repeat customer represented. Cut to a year later, we were open 7 nights a week, 3 shows Saturday, 2 shows Friday, 1 long show each of the other nights. And how did we build that? We built it off of a really weird idea. And it's nothing that you haven't heard before. Be nice. That's all we did. All we did was we were nice. Who were we nice to? First, we were nice to the comics. Being a stand-up myself, I understood what it would take to make the people, and if you're going to be entrepreneurs, this is something to keep in mind, because whatever business you're in, whether it's tech or whether it's a comedy basement that's going to turn into something, you're always in the people business. You're always in the human resource business. because you can't get it done without these wacky blobs of protoplasm that are walking around the planet and that you're going to need. And if you've ever tried, forget about working with people and getting them to work together. Try working with comedians. This is like herding chickens. Because everybody is completely self-involved. But you can be in denial about that, or you can do something about that. And here's what we did. Because I was a comic, I understood what people really wanted. And what does every comic want? It's the reason they're comics. They want respect. They want respect. That's why people stand up in front of other people, strangers, and say, "Dig me. Don't you love me? Aren't I great? Aren't I funny? Aren't I smart? Aren't I fantastic? Please give me all the stuff I didn't get when I was a child." It's like group therapy, except instead of one therapist and a group of patients, it's like a group of therapists and one patient. And that's what stand-up is. Here comes the next patient, and now 500 people, all of whom are therapists, are going to try to make him feel better. So I understood that. So what did we do putting that into action? We paid everybody a little bit more than the other clubs were doing. The other clubs were having riots. They were having labor unrest because the comics were going, "You guys built a big business off of our labor, and you're not paying us hardly anything, if anything." And I said to everybody, "Fellas, we can't pay you what you get on the road. We can't pay you road money. We're a showcase club. It's not a headliner club. A headliner club is a club that says, you know, appearing tomorrow, you know, Dave Chappelle. And then everybody comes because it's Dave Chappelle. We were building a brand called the Comedy Cellar, where, especially in the beginning, I told the bartenders, if anybody asks who's appearing, you don't know. You don't know. Because people come to the club and they have to trust us. You're going to see a good show when you come to the Comedy Cellar. It's going to revolve. It's going to rotate. You might see one out of the same, you know, out of five guys, you might see the same one again, but you'll enjoy him again. So we paid people a little bit more, showing them that respect. Uptown, the comics were only allowed to order from this side of the menu. Now, how demeaning. How demeaning is that? You can order from this side of the menu? We're building a business off of you guys. We said to them, come down, have whatever you want. Even if you're not working that night, come down, have whatever you want. We even made a comedian's table that was only for comedians. And in the beginning, they all like didn't trust it. We're going to get slimed. Something is bad is going to happen at the comedian's table. But it became the hangout. And that's what, and it was, even if it wasn't good business, which it was good business, even if it wasn't good business, Manny and I, that's the kind of people we want. We wanted this to be a place where people, even in the middle of New York, the most ruthless, faceless, nobody cares about nobody place, let this place be an island. And pretty soon, at the comedian's table, Jerry Seinfeld, Chris Rock, Dave Chappelle, Louis C.K., Tony Rock, Ray Romano. If we ever had a situation where some guy didn't show up for his 10-20 spot, no problem. Just went upstairs. "Hey, does anybody want to do... He can't get... He's at catch. He can't do a spot... Traffic, whatever. Do you want to do the spot?" And they'd be going, "No, please, after you." And you're seeing a $1 million show arguing with each other. "No, Chris, you go. No, Jerry, you go. Ray, no, you already did it. So, no, fine, you go." It was insane. So that's the kind of respect and value that we were showing to human resources. On the other end, with the customers, I would stand outside the club every night, and I would shake everybody's hand as people walked out. So I had been on stage. I was the MC in those days. And my bar was, in order to get on the stage, you had to be better than me. That was my bar. Because if you were not better than me, I would do the time. Why would I give up the time? So people had just seen me on stage, and hopefully things went very well. And then they would see me outside asking them, how was the experience? What did you like? What did you not like? And if somebody said, oh, it was all fantastic, I'd go after and say, yes, it was all fantastic. What was the least fantastic part? Anything from the waiters to the drinks to the food to the comics to me to anything, tell me because I want to make it better. And very few people who are in any walk of life, whether you're an entrepreneur or anything, very few people want to hear the bad. And fewer people want to aggressively go after the bad. I mean, you got to be as big a Jew as me to actively go after the bad. Because you understand the Cossacks are coming and you want to be prepared. So, thank you, another first generation person. So those were the pillars that we built the club on. And the win-win situation cost me nothing because Manny had the place. It was already in operation. It was just unbelievably undervalued and underutilized. So I saw the value in that time before the Brazilian piano bar, and showed him how to monetize stuff that was latent for him. So that's one way, if you're going to go into entrepreneurship, if you can find this intersection and we'll call it curating, or we can also call it job creator. Most of us these days are thinking of ourselves as job seekers. And that's fine. I'm not saying there's one versus the other. They're not mutually exclusive. Job seeker is one way to think of yourself in the world as you get out into it. Job creator, well, that's a little bit different. Now you're the cause. You're not the effect. You're the cause of something. And in a world where everybody's looking for jobs, a job called job creator is solving a lot of people's problems. I put a lot of comics to work. I generated a lot of money for these guys, and they were able to learn a lot that they leveraged later on by being the job creator. In terms of what did they learn later on, kind of brings me to the question people often ask when they find out about my background. How did you discover John Stewart? And how hard could that have been? I mean, John Stewart is a massively talented, funny, smart, insightful, well-educated guy. Yeah, you should have seen him on the Tuesday night in February when it was raining outside and there were six drunk Swedish sailors in the Comedy Cellar who didn't speak English. And watch him go through that on an open mic night. Open mic nights, by the way, something else to keep in mind, because in the comedy world, they're called open mic nights. But each of us needs to have our own open mic night, because you need new ideas, even though you're pretty sure most of them are going to stink, and you're going to hate most of them. Most of the people that I saw on open mic nights were terrible. Mitch Kapor, terrible. But in the sea of this badness, and as you ask people for their ideas, whether it's about you, your life, your future, your idea, your entrepreneurial thing, this job that you want, whatever, instead of wanting to be right, try to be happy. Because that's a choice that a lot of people make. The choice in life is, you want to be right or do you want to be happy? If you want to be right, you know, good luck. But if you want to be happy, listen to all these ideas. Open mic night for yourself. For me, that night, it was just one guy after another, who each person did another 6 minutes, dogs versus cats and airline food and the difference between New York and L.A., and my mother hated me, and did you ever notice, and did you ever notice that? Yes, I noticed, stop it. And then up comes this guy, John Stewart, and he stood stiff, and he didn't touch the microphone, and he was a pure monologist. In those days, pure monology was the thing. If you were a prop act, you were considered scum of the earth. If you were a ventriloquist, or if you were anything except a pure word-driven observational monologist, this society of other comics, all of whom had become comics because they had been marginalized by the rest of the world, now decided who they were going to marginalize. Ain't that the way it always happens? So this group decided that anybody who's not a pure monologist, we're going to marginalize them and make them feel terrible and self-conscious and drive them out of the business. Not consciously. This wasn't an evil thing, but it's just the way people are. So John did 6 minutes. Death. Nothing. No, absolutely not a chuckle. Nothing. But I said, oh, wait a second. We've got a guy here with an actual point of view. And that's something you don't see. You don't see a lot of. You see it, I saw it in Bill Maher. Bill Maher was the guy who was in the class ahead of John at that time. And he was already starting to get, you know, well known. But the difference between, and I'll tell you the Bill Maher story later, I'll just say the difference between Bill and John is that in the spectrum of decent human beings, one is at one end and one is at the other. Anyway, I'm going to let the knife wounds heal. But John got nothing, but I saw a genuine point of view. And what do I mean by genuine point of view there? He had the ability to do jokes where the observation caused the laughter. A lot of political comedians or social observation, they'll make an observation or they'll make a statement about politics, which is pretty, you know, run-of-the-mill kind of statement, something you'll see on CNN or whatever it is, and then they'll do a punchline tagged to that. And the level of that comedy, no great shakes. But John's observations in and of themselves did not require, nor did they allow, for any kind of punchline tagged onto that. It was the observation itself that was attempting to elicit the laughter. And it was not attempting to elicit humor. He was not going for smiles. He was going for laughs. The fact that these six chuckleheads didn't get it didn't concern me at all. So at the end of his set, I went over to him. I said, John, I never ask anybody to come back, but would you please come back? And the only note I have for you is tomorrow, hold the microphone. Just hold the mic. And he said, all right. And the next night, he came up, and he did it. First, I was unbelievably impressed that he remembered the note and that he actually took action. He was not so paralyzed. So he was it showed me he was thinking. He was in the moment. He was present. And he held the mic. Then the next night he came by, and he held the mic again. And this time, because he was holding the mic, he started just back and forth. And then as the weeks progressed, he started moving to one side of the stage and to the other side of the stage, kind of by accident. Because he could, because he was no longer tethered to that spot with the cord and the mic. And then, instead of allowing himself to, he started doing it on purpose. And now he started to work the stage. He started to go with purpose to this side of the room and work to this side of the room and look at people in the eye and be present in his body and work to this side of the room. And all of a sudden, the guy became a performer. He was no longer a mouth that was a vehicle for his brilliantly written jokes. Now he was a performer. And that changed everything for him. And the lesson I'd like you all to learn from that is look for ways to untether yourself. Look for ways for you to hold the mic and allow for growth, allow for an unseeable change. What is it going to be? I didn't know for sure that that's what was going to happen. I just knew nothing good was going to happen if he was going to stay tethered to that spot with that mic. So whatever it is for you, whatever your comfort zone is, I'm not saying now change it and go to some other zone, because we don't know if that's going to be right either. I'm saying allow yourself to move out of it. Because every time you change just a few degrees, the angle on the whole thing looks different. Every hallway that you go down, oh, what's down that hallway? I can't tell you what's down that hallway, but I know that there's going to be 11 doors, and you can't see where the doors are. But if you go down that hallway, something new will happen. If it's something good, it really depends on how you play the cards. So the Comedy Cellar was born, and they really should have crushed us. They really should have beaten us. But they were really, I guess, like every incumbent. If you go out and start a company, you become an entrepreneur, the incumbents are focused on their own problems. And it's by the time Alta Vista, I guess, looks up, Google has eaten their lunch. Will somebody do it to Google? I don't know. Those guys are pretty good. But it's conceivable. Will somebody do it to Facebook? It's conceivable. And that's where you guys come in. You know, look at what the defense gives you and go where they ain't. Are there any questions, by the way, so far? I have been waxing lyrical. Anything at all? Who are the incumbents? You mean in the comedy club business when I was doing that, or now? Back then it was Catch a Rising Star, the improvisation, the comic strip, and the incumbents. I just wanted to be the fourth club. I didn't intend to bury the others. The improv closed. Catch a Rising Star closed. The comic strip is still open. You go from being a basement that not a lot of people have heard of to being the legendary Comedy Cellar. You go there pretty quickly. There's about an hour and a half of time where you're actually where you're supposed to be. But I want to just get to a couple other notes that I made here. Whether you're going to look for a job or starting a company on your own, and this is hopefully stuff that you'll be able to glean from the story so far. Okay. Solve somebody's problem. If you can't solve an employer's problem, they're not going to hire you. So you got to ask yourself, what's this guy's problem? How do I solve it? Does a very decent GPA from a very respectable college in a very respectable major, does that solve his problem? Two, being a job creator, a curator, if you will. Three, using a win-win strategy. Four, play to your strengths. Now, we already saw in so many ways how people don't do that. A lot of the comics weren't doing that. They wanted the social safety of being like everybody else. Well, the problem is, if you're like everybody else, you know, you'll recognize this, right? Bell curve, right? Well, if you want to be, if that's the most important thing to you is to be like everybody else, you're going to be right here. You're going to be average. In those days, you're going to be a road rat. You're going to be going, schlepping from one club to another on the road, making $700,000-$800,000 a week, eking out a living. Yes, it will look good when you're 25, 26. It's kind of cool. You fly to Philadelphia from wherever. You go to Chicago. You spend a week. You're headlining. If you're lucky, if you're middling, you're making $600-$700. You're coming home. Hey, I'm a working comic. It's cute when you're 26. It's not so cute when you're 36. And if you want that social safety net of being okay with your peers, well, you're going to be right in the average of the bell curve. If you want success, you have to risk being out here or out here. And the problem is, you don't get any guarantees about which one of this you're going to be once you decide I'm coming out of the middle. Once you say, I'm coming out of the middle and I'm going to do something different, I'm going to risk that, well, you might be a big old success and you might be a big old bomb. But especially at your age, this is a win-win situation. You can't lose. Because even if you're a bomb, you're 22. You're supposed to fail. And what you will learn from doing this stuff and failing at it is much more valuable to you, yourself, your persona, and any future employer than you're going to get from most unpaid internships. So that becomes one of the questions. Are you willing to take yourself out of the middle? And then in playing to your strengths, you want to also spend as little money as possible. There's a concept that is bandied about in tech circles called minimum viable product. And that's what the Comedy Cellar was in its inception. Thursday, Friday, Saturday, a show at 8 o'clock will be out by 10, three shows a night. That's all. No risk. It was the minimum viable product, the least amount that I needed to do in order to prove the concept in a real-world commercial situation. And if it didn't work, I wasn't out any money. And then six, you're not going to like this one. Outwork everybody else. Because the people who win in these competitions are not the people who are better than or the people who are more talented than. It's the people who work harder than anybody else. Which brings us back to this. Because unless you're operating from here, unless you genuinely love what you do, unless you would do it for free, but are now trying to figure out, well, I don't want to do it for free. I want to monetize it. But unless you're doing something you love to do, you will never outwork somebody who actually loves it. Because you're going to be looking at your watch. Is it 5 o'clock? Is it 5 o'clock? It's happy hour. It's 5 o'clock. And they're going to be going, oh, I hope it's not 5 o'clock. I'm still working on this thing. I got to figure this out. I got to come. They're going to be taking a shower and thinking about it. They're going to be dreaming and thinking about it. They're going to eat your lunch. So for those of us who might say or whose parents might say, yeah, that's a lot of hippie crap, that do what you love to do thing, let's live in the real world, shall we? Because that's a lot of 1968 hippie baloney. I put it to you. Thank you, Santa's here. I put it to you that it is actually not only not uncommercial, but that doing what you love is the way to maximize the probability of your commercial success. Is that a breathtaking idea? It feels breathtaking as I said it. Is it as breathtaking as I should I be as impressed as I am with myself right now? I should be. Okay. Well, this is a revolutionary idea. It is time. We've got to storm the Bastille here. The Bastille was a place in France, which is in Europe. It's another place. It's not important. But you need to have a little bit of a French Revolution for yourself and ask yourself, maybe the stuff I've been told doesn't work. What if, just what if, tonight when you're getting drunk, play the what if game. What if this guy Grundfest, what if he was right? What if this is actually the only way to become commercially successful? What do I really love? Let's try this just for 10 seconds, okay? I promise it won't hurt. A 10-second experiment. Close your eyes and just ask yourself, what do you love to do? What do you love to do? What do you do? Nobody's paying you. Man, I could do that all day. I'm just so obsessed with that. I'm so curious about that. Oh, when something like that's going on, I always go and I always do that. And I always, okay. You got that? Okay. So just doing that. By the way, just a show of hands. How many had something come into mind? Something popped into your mind? Okay. Let me ask you this. Have you thought about that in the last week? You have thought about it in the last week. Okay, great. So now the question becomes, now you're already way ahead. Now you know something. You can change your mind, but for right now, you know. And so now the question is, if you had a magic wand, another 10-second exercise. If I had a magic wand and I told you anything that you tried would succeed, what would you try? Just think about that. Whatever pops into your head, no right or wrong answer. Now, if later, again, as you're drinking, think about that and see if you can really live in that environment. Imagine what you're doing. What I was doing with the Comedy Cellar, I knew what I wanted. I wanted to open the comedy club. I saw myself doing it. And when I found the Comedy Cellar, and this has happened to me several times in life, on the things that have succeeded. When I found the Comedy Cellar, the physical location, I had a deja vu experience. I felt like I've been here because in my mind I have been here. It was exactly what I pictured. It was exactly what I pictured. And then what do you actually do? Which leads us to these six rules. And as far as rules go, let me just say this. There are no rules. There are laws, and I suggest you obey those. But there are no rules. Rule number one is there are no rules. Everybody who follows the rules is going to be right there in the middle of the bell curve. Okay, so let me just start wrapping this up because I have a feeling that it's a good time to do that and tell you that I've been working with a few fellas, no girls yet, but a few fellas who are early 20s. And who are in similar situations. It is just something that has evolved over the last 2 or 3 months. I'm hanging out in the wrong places, I guess, and meeting guys that are just out of college and trying to figure out what they're going to do. And they all have great educations from very respectable schools, and they're being faced with this whole unpaid internship thing. And so I always get into this kind of conversation with them. What do you love to do? Now, one of them I found, they're kind of like puppies, and I adopt them. I don't know why. You know, guess you know, you get to a certain age in life, and you go, you look at the mirror, you go, I can't possibly be this old. This is insane. What happened to my hair? I used to be cute. The girls liked me. What happened? Then you reach a point where women just kind of look through you. You're not really there anymore. You're not there. They don't mind your presence. It's just no longer an issue. So, I may have shared too much. But these pups that I seem to be accumulating, one I found because my 10-year-old is a something of a Minecraft savant. Anybody play Minecraft? Some. Okay. Minecraft is this online game thing that has last year grossed $159 million from a grand total of 35 people working in a house in Sweden. Yeah, I know. But it's this really fantastic, no winners, losers, no violence, except if you download the modifications. And, you know, 10-year-old boys will always download the modifications. Perfectly peaceful, creative game. Oh, there's a way to have a gun? Oh, great. TNT? Let's build an entire house out of TNT. What could possibly go wrong? And so I, being the kind of dad that I am, I went out and said, well, if this kid has an affinity for this, and he seems to, by my eye, maybe I can find him a coach. I found this guy who now comes to the house twice a week and coaches him on Minecraft techniques, and now they're into coding. And by the way, can anybody hear code? Okay, you can just ignore everything I said, okay? Just ignore me completely. If you can code, the world is your oyster. The entire world belongs to you. Then there's the rest of us. So I was talking to him and said, well, what are you left? I love Minecraft, and I love the gaming thing, and I love... Well, it started out from, okay, coach my kid. Now he's coaching other kids. And now I said, hey, how about a Minecraft camp? Get kids. I'll give you the house. Have the first week of Minecraft camp here, my house. And they did. Now he's renting a place for the summer nearby, and it's going to be a whole Minecraft camp because 10-year-old boys love this stuff. So what did I kind of nudge him into doing that he... I'm not going to take any credit for it because I just suggested it. He's actually doing it. He's doing this. He took what he loved to do, found a way to monetize it. He's working in the intersection of that. He's now curating it. He found a location. Okay, the location he first found was mine, but that's okay. Now he's paying for another location. And he's hiring two other guys, two of his buddies, who know about media and know about other gaming kinds of things. It's the exact Comedy Cellar model. There's another guy who's a musician, even worse than being a comedian. He's a musician. Try to make a living that way. And he's a class. What he loves is classical music. This is something else that is now... In its early stages. I said, well, you know, there are comedy clubs, there are jazz clubs, there are no classical music clubs. There's no place to go, have a couple of drinks, and watch a string quartet, or a brass quintet, or a violinist, or your girl in bikini, you know, playing the tuba, whatever it is. And so he's now copying the Comedy Cellar model, but using classical music as the stone in the stone soup. So those are a couple of ways, and there are a couple other people that I can tell you about also. And will they be huge successes? I don't know. It's all in the execution, and it's all in the future. But I can promise you this. They're not going to lose any money. They're going to learn a lot more than they would in the other alternatives that they have presented to them. They are already, when I talk to them, their level of excitement on a Tuesday is so much higher than it was. They're meeting life. They're being proactive with life. They're looking forward to, can I actually eat this entire elephant that I've set out to eat? You know, okay, one bite at a time, but I'm going to do this. And they're never going to regret having done it. And they're young enough that if it fails, it's not going to be a failure because they will have learned a tremendous amount that they will then bring to their next thing. So with that, I would just implore each of you to remember it's not the world out there that's going to be your biggest obstacle. It's going to be the world in here. And if you can get past that, and I believe you all can, you're going to be great, and you're going to go out and do us all proud. Thank you very much for your time.
Hey, so something that you kind of described as, especially with the Comedy Cellar, was kind of proving to other people that they should speak at this venue. So as young people, how do we convince people to give us a chance? Because it sounds like from your career, you were able to prove to other people to give you a chance. And how do we do that, given that we don't have much credibility as young people?
Well, let me say something to you that my dad said to me before he died, because after he died, he really. It's just no talking to the man. I said to him, I asked him a very similar question. You know, they told me I'm too young. And he was from the old country. He came over in 1951 from Russia, Europe, whatever, you know, for after the war, you know, the one with all the shooting. And so they, and the yelling and the screaming. And they came over here. And he said, Bill, they will tell you you're too young until they tell you you're too old. So to hell with this age thing. If I'm a person that has a problem, if I'm Manny was, I don't know, 50, whatever. He was this hard-nosed businessman, former cab driver, oud player. I mean, a wild guy. And here comes this 25-year-old pup. Years later, Manny said, you know, I didn't know what the hell you were talking about. You want to start a comedy club in the basement with the thing? What? I didn't know what you were talking about. I said, you know something, Manny, I didn't know what I was talking about either. But there's a sense. So I think that if you show someone that you recognize their situation, that you're thinking about it from his point of view or from her point of view, and now you offer them a win-win situation. Here's a way for us to do something, and you can't get hurt, and maybe we win big, maybe we don't, but we can't lose. I think just that is such a refreshing approach, because most people, you know, most people who approach you with something want something from you. They're not looking to give you something. So if you want to talk specifically, if you have a specific, I'm happy to talk about the specific and how to reverse engineer the specific into this model. Is there a specific that you have? Not an idea that one of these guys is going to steal, because I can see right away they're going to run away with the idea. But do you have a specific? Or okay. Did that kind of answer the question?
Yeah.
Yeah, kind of? Okay.
I guess I had a comedy-related question, since you've sort of been in the industry so long.
How do you say so long?
Okay.
it hurts,
I guess.
Me. It hurts. And by the way, can I just jump in here? We have time, right? When I went to Los Angeles for my Hollywood years, when I sold the Comedy Cellar and went to L.A. to become a writer-producer television guy, by the way, same thing happened. I knew what I wanted. I could see myself in the room, in the situation. When I finally did get into the room in Los Angeles, I had that deja vu experience of, oh my God, this is exactly what I envisioned. It's very odd. I will offer this word of caution. The skill set of being an entrepreneur versus the skill set of being an employee, these are massively different. And please remember this, because they are almost mutually exclusive. They're the opposite of each other. So if you try to be an entrepreneur and then you try to be an employee, just remember to take off the entrepreneur hat, because the entrepreneur's job is to do what's best for the business. The employee's job is to do what the boss thinks will help the boss's career. If you want a job, demonstrate clearly that you understand that and can do that, and the job will be yours. Go ahead.
Okay, so my question was...
Comedy, long time, very old, yes.
Yeah, yeah. what's your opinion on how you think comedy has evolved in terms of sort of how it's used as a show, like a social commentary, compared to the days of like Lenny Bruce, George Carlin, where those guys were sort of just like attacking society, whereas now you sort of, I don't know, it seems soft, I guess. I wanted to get your opinion on that.
Where nowadays stand-up comedy, because they're yeah. different, there are different you know, arenas of comedy. You've got your stand-ups, you've got your sitcoms, you've got your movies, you've got your, you know, YouTube kind of user-generated stuff. So they're all different areas of comedy. If you're talking about stand-up comedy per se, you know, we live in a world with Bill Maher and Jon Stewart and Stephen Colbert. There is some, you know, hard-hitting stuff in there. Back in the day, the Lenny Bruce and the George Carlin and Richard Pryor. Richard Pryor, by the way, if you ask any stand-up comic, you know, for who are the top 100 guys, there's Richard, and then there's a big gap, and then you can all argue. But everybody goes, there's Richard. And Richard never did much in the way of politics. Richard went where truly no man has gone before and no one has gone since, which is inside. Chris Rock, as wonderful as he is, and by the way, talk about, if you want to see an example of outworking everybody, Chris Rock will tell you himself, he was not the funniest guy in any room when he was starting, but he outworked everybody, and he is a tremendous student of the form. Chris Rock can quote you chapter and verse on Bob Newhart routines from 1964. Anybody who's really good at whatever they do, whether it's stand-up or anything else, they stand on the shoulders of giants. They are students of the form. They know, they're not trying to reinvent it. They try to steal from it and make it their own. And then eventually it becomes just their own, and they don't. And the influence recedes in the back. So I think we have some great ones now. I wish somebody would work with the material that Richard worked with, but it takes a tremendous amount of courage. I did two shows for Viacom. One's called Prior Offenses. Which starred Eddie Griffin for Showtime, in which I took Richard's stand-up material and I deconstructed it into the component characters and then created a film script in which it was Richard, and then there was a woman who was all a compendium of all the white women in his comedy, and an African-American woman, and his grandmother. And we were really able to show how... His was a comedy of pain. The slug line under it was called Prior Offenses, Cry Till You Laugh. And I wanted to pull his material inside out and show you really what he had done that was so amazing. We did it. We only did the one special, and then that was it. And then I did a thing for... These were the last two projects of Richard's life. And look who did it, a white Jew. But... Anybody who knows me was not surprised. Anybody said, well, of course, who better? It was for Comedy Central, and it was called the Richard Pryor I Ain't Dead Yet Mother Comedy Special. And we interviewed everybody and put it together in a really cool way, so you can probably go online and find it. Does that answer your question about the comedy question? No, you're not satisfied. Go ahead, tell me. You see, this is what I do. Go ahead, tell me why it's bad. Tell me. I want to fix it.
I mean, I guess... do you think there's ever going to be somebody that's going to come along and be that big again, right? Like, as somebody in, like, their 20s, the only real person that I can think of is, like, a Louis C.K.?
Yeah.
Do you think there's going to be somebody else that's going to come along and really just paradigm shift the way we think about... comedians.
Absolutely. There's always somebody new. Is it the end of science question? You know, a few years back, there were people saying, well, that's it. We know everything we need to know. No, we don't. We don't know. There's always going to be somebody who's then going to rock our boat. Listen, Dane Cook was as hot as you could be, right? Yeah, what happened there? You know? So now Louis C.K., who actually has some something going on, now that, and he's, that's the amazing thing, that a guy who is mining something of gravitas and substance, that he's actually popular, that's the amazing thing. Because, so the answer to your question is yes, there will definitely be. And then after that guy, there'll be somebody else. And maybe it's not a guy, maybe it'll be a girl, maybe it'll be a monkey, I don't know. Any other questions?
Take two more.
Yeah, oh.
My question is about how do you find the big dogs in the entertainment industry? Like for tech, to find VCs or angels, there's a kind of a set process. You just go to them with your idea, you pitch it, you show them what you have. But let's say you're trying to start a nightclub, like in San Francisco. How do you find the big dogs when you're just a new college graduate?
You don't find the big, if you want to start a nightclub, that's easy. You just steal what I did. You find a place that right now is a storage room. It's a basement. It's a back room. It's an upstairs. You find a place and you just steal my thing. Go to the guy who owns it now and say, look, you're overlooking money that I could make for you. So you want to start a jazz club. So let's say you want to start a jazz club. Jazz. All right. Whatever it is. So you want to start a jazz club. So you go, and you say to the guy, I'm going to be responsible for bringing in people in here, people that you can sell food and beverage to, and we'll have a cover charge. So let's say we have a $10 cover charge, and we have a $10 food. You keep the $10. I'll keep the $10. I'll pay the acts, and I'll be responsible for marketing it and getting people in here. Well, the guy's sitting there going, I got nothing to lose. So avoid the big dogs. The big dogs don't need you. The big dogs will eat you. The big dogs will kill you. The big dogs are pit bulls. They're not. That's why they're big dogs. They're not poodles. You don't want the pit bulls. They're not. No, you go to the poodles and you say, hey, Mr. Poodle, what are you doing with your room here? It's empty. I can make you more money for free. It's a win-win situation, and you don't have to pay me anything to do it. He'll start looking for, well, what's the catch? And that your biggest problem is going to be assuring him there's no catch. If you win, I win, and then we progress. Now, let me give you specific advice as you go and do this. Own the name of the club. Let me repeat that. Own the name of the club. Okay? He's going to say, well, wait a second, you can't own the name of my joint. If he says that, here's what you say. Okay, it's your joint, it's your physical location, this is the name of your, okay, fine. But for anything else that does not involve people coming in here and eating and drinking and all of that stuff, I own the name for everything else and trademark it and own it. Okay? You will thank me.
One more right in the middle there.
Down, here it goes, here it goes. This is like the hot dog at the ball game. This is, yes.
Hey, how's it going?
So, I'm hanging in there, you?
I'm all right as well, so
right.
Thanks.
That's good.
So you spoke a lot about your successes and everything. In the beginning, you kind of said you had a lot of failure and everything, so I'm kind of going to bring that back to the light a little bit. I just want
to
know...
Just to hurt me. Yes, failure.
Sorry, because... Yes. I mean, as a comedian, I guess I've always thought about like the very first kind of gigs you do. I'm sure not all of them. I mean, a lot of people would probably fail as far as like getting the crowd to laugh. So, did that happen to you? Like, where it's you like the first couple is kind of tough to get people to laugh. And if so, how did you kind of face that when you went home?
Oh, you've conflated so many issues here. There are so many issues here. But let's try to parse them out one at a time. Okay, first of all, I'm sorry if I neglected to showcase my heart-wrenching failures sufficiently. One of the reasons I gave this piece of advice to this young man here about own the name, trademark the name, own it for everything outside of that joint is because that may or may not have been one of the failures and mistakes that I made in my life. You may... infer from this whatever I may be implying. As a stand-up, one of the, and I went to a club the other night, and I always promised myself I'm not going to go out to any more clubs, but I went out to a club the other night with a friend, and it was an open mic night. And the problem that most young comics encounter and the mistake they made is that they're looking for laughs instead of looking for themselves. Ooh, that sounds crunchy. Ooh, that's really, ooh, very zen. If all you're looking for is laughs, you will meet the demands of the moment, but you're not going to meet the demands of the future. You're not going to meet the vision. The thing that Richard had and the thing that all the great ones had is the ability to tolerate silence. The reason I only got pretty good, I mean, I was good, but I was never as good as I wanted to be, was because I couldn't tolerate the silence. I was a laugh whore. I would do whatever it took to get the laugh. And then the audience would be fooled into thinking they had a good time. And so the first thing you got to do is look for why should anybody listen to you? If all you've got is jokes, well, then the next guy's got jokes too. So why should you be sucking the oxygen out of this place instead of any number of other people? Back to the bell curve here. If all you want is to find a way to get a laugh now, well then, congratulations, welcome to the middle. But if what you want is to do something beyond that, you have to take the chance of, are you going to end up being Louis C.K., and it only took him 15 years. Louis, by the way, came to talk about my dad. Louis came to Thanksgiving. I adopt people. He came to Thanksgiving one year when my dad was still alive, because after he died, it was untoward to bring him to Thanksgiving. But Louis and my dad used to get into these Chekhovian debates and whatever, talk about stuff I didn't even understand. And it was like Louis was the son my father always wished he had, you know. And so then I would get jealous. Louis, really, Louis, with my father, really, you know, have you no shame. But what is my point? You have to risk the silences to find the thing that makes you you, so that you can play to your strengths. How does one cope with bombing? Nobody likes it. But the question really is, what are you going to do about it? If you go home, you try to write better stuff. You always tape your sets, because it could be the difference between an extra syllable. That extra syllable in there killed the laugh. So it's not that the joke was bad. The execution wasn't spot on. Stand-up is the most peculiar art form. It's entirely peculiar. But the good news is it's one of the most, possibly the only objective art form. Because you can hear the laugh or not. The audience isn't lying. They're laughing or they're not laughing. You can even put a metric on it and say, well, let's check how many decibels that laugh is. So it's completely objective. So I would say, look for what makes you you. Play to your strengths so that you come out of the middle, and there's a reason to create a demand for you. And that's true for all of us. If you can put your strengths together in such a way so that only you can fill that demand, then you have zero competition. So ask yourself later, when you have a moment, how in the world could I do that? How could I take my skill sets, put them in this odd combination where I'm the only person really who's positioned to fill that demand? And you'll have zero competition. Will you have any demand for the thing? That's a different question. Does that answer your... What part did it not answer?
Well, I mean, I guess I wanted to hit the more personal, just more on you.
oh, you wanted to hear about the crying and the drinking and the drug taking and all of that and the manic activity in order to distract myself from the internal void that I was trying to fill through the activity of stand-up by getting strangers to laugh and hence quell the existential angst and pain that I had been growing up with. I'm just taking a guess. Is this what you were looking for? Don't go like this. I'm just, because it's bad enough this guy's old, you're going like this. It's, I'm going to be leaving here with no shred of dignity at all. And then something you didn't ask about, but I think is related, is heckling. Most young comics take heckling as an adversarial proceeding, and they feel, and I did it too, they feel that they need to win. This guy now said something, and now I need to best him, or else all hell will break loose. Crowd control issues, all kinds of stuff like that. After a couple of years of that, here's what I started doing. Somebody would, in the middle of my set, somebody would heckle me. And I would say, gee, sir, you must have had a very hard day. I mean, here you are in the middle of all these people. And to feel compelled to say something as, you know, untoward as that. Gosh, has it been a long day? And he'd say something else. And I'd say, you know something? If you're going to heckle, please allow me. Let me give you a couple of tips, all right? And I would go out and I would sit down next to him. And I would heckle the now empty stage mercilessly, far beyond anything he was saying or could conceive of saying, because I have heard it all. And I just, and then I would run up onto the stage and say, well, I'm taken aback. That's no way to talk in public. And then I'd run back out to him and I'd yell more crap at the now empty stage. And I'd come back and I'd be taken aback again. And by the time I did this three times, the guy was my best friend. The audience was so thrilled that the danger, because that's what you're always worried about when you go to a comedy club, is some idiot, drunk guy going to ruin the night for everybody. I parked the car, I paid a babysitter, I paid a cover charge, it's costing me a lot of money. Is some idiot going to ruin it for us? And is the comic going to be able to help it and turn it around? It's judo. You take that energy, you don't fight it, you use it. And I think there are a lot of other places in life where you find that. When you get an objection, because heckling is just a sales objection, and a sales objection is just an opportunity to make a sale. Because the person's telling you, you're not ringing my bell, buddy. If you know how to ask, well, in what way am I not ringing your bell? If you know how to ask that, they'll tell you what to do in order to make the sale. Have I come close? Oh, and the drinking and the crying and the girls and all of that stuff. Yeah. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.